It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, Afghan traditions. You know, when a country's been at war for a long time, all you ever hear about is guns and soldiers and drones. You don't hear much of the stuff of ordinary daily life. Music, art, poetry, games. Today, a few things you might not know about Afghanistan, including its national sport. That's a scene from the short film Buzkashi Boys. It's a coming-of-age story set in the world of Buzkashi, which is a game that goes way back in Afghan history. It's a form of horse polo, played with whips and a dead goat. Sam French directed the movie, which was filmed in Kabul and nominated for an Oscar. Producer Charles Monroe Kane got the story behind the film.
Sam, why don't you tell me about the first time you saw Buzkashi?
Well, I first saw Buzkashi when I first got to Afghanistan in 2008. I had arrived fresh off the plane and went up to Mazar-e-Sharif up north. Up in Mazar-e-Sharif, they really play Buzkashi. It's huge. So it was a humongous field with mountains in the background, and there were no out of bounds. So there's a bunch of people, thousands of people standing in a big circle, and sometimes the horsemen would just plow right through the crowd.
Well, I think I should interrupt here. I don't think anyone listening probably knows what Buzkashi is, including me. How does it play? What's the game?
So Buzkashi is the national sport of Afghanistan. It's been played for hundreds and thousands of years. It's basically horse polo, but it's played with a dead goat carcass instead of a ball. So if you can imagine 12-foot-tall men on horses riding around on a field trying to grab a dead goat carcass, gallop around a flag, and put it into a circle in the middle of the field.
You know, I can't actually really imagine it. But the more I think about it, I did spend some time looking it up. And it was amazing to see. It looks just intense and brutal. And I think the matches I saw were in the snow and the mud and people were running into spectators. And all the time there's this dead goat being due to the center. It was kind of amazing, actually.
Yeah, Buzkashi is an incredibly visual game. I mean, if just imagine horse polo with a dead goat carcass. And there's a 50 to 100 horsemen.
Did you say 100? You said 100, right?
In Mazar-e-Sharif, where I first saw Buzkashi, there were hundreds of horsemen in this wide, vast plain with dust being kicked up by the horses as they thunderously gallop past the crowd, all tight together and their breath is steaming in the mountain cold winter air. And they're rearing up and over each other. And then in the middle of this mess, a guy reaches down and grabs a goat carcass from the ground and struggles and breaks free of the scrum and gallops away around this flag and then back and throws the goat into the circle.
With his hands, right? There's no tools.
With his hands, yeah. So he reaches all the way over down to the ground and grabs it with his hands. There's been stories of horses that have been trained to pick it up with their teeth, but that's a legend.
I love it. It's a good legend, though.
When I get in.
What does it mean? I know it's the national sport of Afghanistan, but what does it mean to Afghan culture, this sport?
I was quite shocked when I went to Afghanistan that, you know, they like to fight everything against each other. So I went to a camel fight in Mazar-e-Sharif. There's dog fighting, there's cock fighting. It's an incredibly poetic country, but it's an incredibly harsh country as well. And the Afghan people are as hard as the mountains. They have incredible hospitality, and I've been welcomed in warmly to many Afghan houses, and I absolutely love them. But also very hard. So Buzkashi, I think, is a testament to how hard they are. I think at one point, an American cowboy came over to Afghanistan and went to a Buzkashi game and had planned to go and get on a horse and join and chickened out because it's pretty violent.
You know, it makes me think it's like the country. I was once described to me Afghanistan as brutal but beautiful, and it seems like the sport is brutal but beautiful as well.
Yes, indeed, it is. Yeah.
You know, we should back up for a second. Could you give us just a brief thumbnail sketch of the film?
Sure. Buzkashi Boys is actually about two young 12-year-old boys living in Kabul. They're both very poor. One is a blacksmith's son and one is a street kid. He's a spandi, which he waves this sweet seed that he burns in a can, and it's supposed to ward off the evil eye. And so he's begging on the street. But they're best friends, Rafi and Ahmad, and they both dream of being bisgashi writers. Of course, that dream is almost unattainable for young, poor Afghan kids, but they do dream of being bisgashi writers. And the film is about their life and their friendship, and it's about their one small step into being men.
You're an American from Philadelphia. How in the world did you end up making a film, nominated for Academy Award, I might add, a film in Afghanistan, a country in which your country is waging a war in right now?
Yeah, well, life definitely takes interesting turns sometimes. I guess I can give you a brief background of my story. I went to USC Film School, graduate school in Los Angeles, and one of my very close friends and collaborator in film school was this guy, Martin Rowe. And he introduced me to this wonderful woman named Anna, who's also British, and she worked for the British government and was posted to Afghanistan in 2008. So I packed up and went to Afghanistan to be with Anna. And I found a country that you do not see in the news. What I saw on the news before going was just bombings and bullets and the Taliban. And I got there, and it was an incredibly rich country. So I decided to stay and start a documentary film production company to try to tell some of these stories that you don't see on the news. That led into 5 years later, I was still there. Martin actually came and visited me in Afghanistan in 2009, and we had been writing this $100 million science fiction film script at the time together, and he got there, and we started traveling around the country, and he was seeing it for the first time, and I was seeing it for the first time again through his eyes. And we said, we have to write a narrative fiction film set here. And that was the genesis of Bisgashi Boys.
Your narrative fiction film is the first Western film to be made entirely in Afghanistan since 1978, since the Soviet invasion. What was the logistics like trying to film during a war in Afghanistan?
The logistics of filming Bisgashi Boys were definitely not easy. We didn't want to just make a film. We wanted to try to help Afghan filmmakers because I had been there and looking around, the TV industry has been supported by the international assistance and it's doing relatively well. But cinema itself hasn't been doing very well because when the Taliban came in, they burned cinemas to the ground. They tried to burn all the film reels they could find and everyone fled the country. So now there's a group of older filmmakers there who have come back and are making films. But there's a whole generation, new generation, there's a generation gap, and the new generation doesn't have access to resources or expertise to make films. So we decided to start an NGO, nonprofit, called the Afghan Film Project to try to foster Afghanistan's film industry and help any way we can to train Afghan filmmakers. And Bisgashi Boys, we wanted to have as our pilot project to actually bring on some trainees and have them have real-world experience in mentor-mentee relationships on the set on a real production.
You know, I was thinking about the film while I was watching it. Okay, it's kind of basically a coming-of-age film set in a sports setting, which I dig. But I was like, why did you choose that? Was it politically calculated? There's no war in the film. I mean, there's obviously a lot of poverty in the film, but there's no war. With all the rich subject matter around war, it's interesting that you chose not to do a film about war.
It was a very conscious choice on our part not to do a film about the war. And that there's the reason for that is because we want to do a universal story and also show very clearly that there are people who live in Afghanistan, normal people just like you and just like me, who have hopes and dreams. And we didn't want to make it political. We wanted to make it personal. So we chose a coming-of-age story, which is a universal story. It's about two kids who take one step into adulthood. Everyone's gone through that. And they have dreams, you know, and everyone has dreams. So this country, while it's very poor, there are still people who yearn for a better future.
Sam French, talking with Charles Monroe Kane about Sam's Oscar-nominated film, Bisgashi Boys. How long before the children of Afghanistan see a better future? Afghan novelist Khaled Hosseini believes it may not be much longer.
To the average person, you say the word Afghanistan, and the set of images that it conjures is so different from my childhood memories. I was fortunate enough to live through the final years of an era that is an almost forgotten bygone era now. These were the days before extremism and before the Taliban, before the criminal networks and the terrorists and the all the foreign troops and so on. I cherish those memories. I wouldn't trade them for anything. They're memories that I've dipped into in my novels over and over again. We have more or less passed the baton on now to the youth of Afghanistan, and I think the memories that will end up serving Afghanistan well is those of the youthful population of Afghanistan. It's a fundamentally young country. 60% is under the age of 20. And they've come of age during the war, and they will use those memories to shape a different future for Afghanistan. It can't be stopped. New experiences, new ways of thinking will infiltrate Afghanistan, and I think that is the way of the future. The immediate future may be cloudy, may be worrisome, and may be painful to watch. But I think ultimately Afghanistan will change from within because of its young population that does have these painful memories, and I think they're motivated to do something about them.
Khaled Hosseini is the author of the best-selling novel, The Kite Runner. He was born in Afghanistan, and he'll be back later in the hour. But first, before 9/11, before the Taliban, Afghanistan was famous in the West not for war, but for hand-woven carpets, some of the most beautiful in the world.
Two factors determine the beauty of a carpet. One is the density of its knots. An experienced carpet dealer will count the knots by ear, running his fingernail across the hard ridges on the reverse side of the rug. Designs are plenty, but which design a customer finds attractive is only a matter of taste. True beauty, on the other hand, is indisputable.
Freelance journalist Anna Bodkin had been covering Afghanistan for 10 years when she decided to tell a different story. She went way up into the northern desert to a village called Oka. It's a place so tiny even Google can't find it. Oka is a rug-weaving village, and the people there make carpets saturated with color in geometric patterns that go back for centuries. Just one can sell in the West for tens of thousands of dollars. Very little of that actually makes it back to the village, though. Steve Paulson talks with Anna Bodkin about her book, The World is a Carpet.
Now, one thing that I found fascinating in your description of the making of these carpets is perfection is not actually that highly valued. In fact, one of the signs that these are handmade is that there are flaws in the carpets.
Well, first of all, in the Muslim tradition, perfection, man-made perfection, offends the omnipotence of God. So perfection is not allowed in a carpet. And sometimes a weaver will, on purpose, weave a mistake into her carpet. But that usually is not necessary because a carpet takes on the shape and the life of a weaver because it's woven over a long period of time, you know, between 4 and 9 months. And so there will be a moment when the weaver is distracted because a goat had stumbled into or onto her loom and she has to stand up and chew the goat away. Or, for example, a neighbor came in and started gossiping and the weaver started laughing and forgot the count of thread and had accidentally woven an extra petal into a stylized almond tree, and so on and so forth. So each carpet is unique and becomes the diary of the carpet weaver.
Hmm. Well, the woman who you focus on, the particular weaver, is named Thaura. What was she like?
Very taciturn young woman in her early 30s. Probably, because most Afghans who are illiterate, and most Afghans are illiterate, very rarely know how old they are. Who wants to count the seasons of privation? Very quiet most of the time, but very open to sex gossip and giggles a lot when somebody comes in and tells her dirty jokes. She is a mother now of 3 children. She is one of the few women in Oka who does not take opium as a palliative because her father-in-law forbids it.
Hmm. So opium is widespread in this village?
Opium is omnipresent in this village because there is no other way to keep aches and pains at bay. There are no doctors nearby. There are no clinics. There are no pharmacies. So the only thing that you can use when you have a backache, and you almost always have a backache if you live in Akka, or a stomachache, you take a little bit of opium. If your child is crying because he's hungry or he's teething, you give him or her a little bit of opium. If you're pregnant and you have a backache and you feel nauseous, you take a little bit of opium. So you're exposing your child to opium prenatally. So basically, it's a village of addicts.
Wow. And also a village that makes extraordinary carpets.
It's a village of people who tell amazing stories. It's a village of people who are extraordinary hosts. It's a village of people who are probably sinners, and some are magnanimous and some are greedy and some probably are thieves and others are something. It's a village that is a sliver of humanity. It's a village of people just like us, just in different circumstances.
How did Thawra learn to make carpets?
She doesn't remember. Her daughter, Leila, who was 5 or 4 years old when I was in the village, was already helping her weave. So probably Thawra was 4 or 5 years old when she was helping her mother weave. And her mother probably was 4 or 5 years old when she was helping her mother weave. This is how the craft is passed down.
This is a very poor village, and I think it was at one point in your book you say that the families who make these carpets earn something like 40 cents a day, and it might cost $60 to buy the yarn for one rug, the rug that they're going to make the whole year. And then the scale of all of this starts to go up as these carpets are sold. They might go to a local dealer, but sold for he'll sell them for, what, $200? And then by the time they get to the United States, they sell for thousands of dollars, right?
Carpets that are exported out of Afghanistan can travel either west to Istanbul or east to Islamabad or Peshawar in Pakistan, or they can fly out of Kabul south to Dubai. And that is where they gain hundreds of percent of their value. And then, of course, when they get from there to, say, Frankfurt or New York or San Francisco or Madison, Wisconsin, they become extraordinarily expensive.
How much are they sold for?
Here in the States, between $5,000 and $20,000 per carpet.
Wow. Which kind of makes you wish that the women who actually make them made more money.
A lot of things make me wish that women who make carpets made more money, not just the price, the exuberant, extortionist price of carpets that people pay for them here, but also the fact that, oh, I wish for these women healthy children who don't die of common cold that goes untreated and then becomes something worse. I wish for these women stomachs that are not so empty. I wish for these women ibuprofen when they have a headache, you know, a warm pair of socks in the winter.
Did you ever feel like you were in a bit of an ethical quandary there? I mean, because I'm guessing that that you could have helped solve some of the financial problems of the family that you were spending all this time with. I mean, you probably could have arranged to have them, you know, sell one of their carpets to a North American dealer for a lot of money. Did you ever consider this?
Okay, so let's say I agreed to help this one family in a village of 240 people, all of whom know me. How do I explain not helping everybody else? How do I then leave and never come back or don't come back for a few years? And what happens to this family? How are they viewed in their community? You know, when I go to – Steve, feeling inadequate is sort of how you normally feel when you work in extremis. I feel extremely inadequate to the pain of the people, to the pain that I witness. And, you know, I console myself by bringing little treats, you know, a couple hundred kilos of rice, some onions. I console myself by saying that by telling stories that I witness, I am contributing somehow to the larger base of knowledge of the people who actually can help, can come and build something, can bring a team of a mobile team of healthcare workers to the village once every 3 months, for example, do things like that. And that's sort of where my job can find an outlet and can find a solution. But it's extremely hard, and it's hard to watch devastation and know that any kind of help you can offer is a Band-Aid.
Yeah. Did you feel like your job was essentially bearing witness? I mean, you were the person giving testimony of how these people are living.
You were saved not in order to live. You have little time. You must give testimony. That's a poem from a poem by Zbigniew Herbert, a Polish poet. That's sort of my lodestar. I guess that's also how I comfort myself when I feel very upset with how little I can do. I'm a storyteller, and I think that the idealist in me believes that somehow my storytelling can make the world a little closer.
Yeah. Could we end with another reading from your book?
I'm going to read from a passage from the end of the book. And what is happening here is my host, who has known me for almost 2 years, refuses to let me stay at his house. At length, Baba Nazar said, "Anna, I know in the past I have invited you to stay, but I don't think you should spend the night here." A deep breath, and suddenly I pictured us the way a bird would see us, a white dove cast off course, or a demoiselle crane perhaps halfway on its hallowed and time and again desecrated migration across the big slate sky. Two people working, a woman carrying food, an importunate visitor, and an old man barefoot in his black galoshes, his glasses held on his head by string, his Soviet shotgun a poor match for the war around him. Five tiny and fragile figures in the sodden desert, a poor man's carpet decocted out of an eternity of violence and generosity and grace. Each of us flawed, and so complete. All of us woven into a time warp named Oka.
Anna Badkin's book is called The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. Steve Paulson spoke with her. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and today we're looking at Afghanistan through the lens of art, not war. One thing you might not know is that in Afghan culture, poetry is revered. People share poems on popular radio shows, and among rural Pashtun women, there's a hidden tradition of poems spoken only among women, like this one. I call your stone. One day you'll look and find I'm gone. American journalist Eliza Griswold discovered that poem when she read about the death of a teenage girl, a poet who called herself Rahila Muska. She lived in Helmand, one of the Taliban strongholds, and when her family discovered that she was writing poetry, they beat her and they burned her poems. And in response, Rahila committed suicide by covering herself with cooking oil and setting herself on fire. That is a terrible story. And Eliza Griswold, who is a poet herself, could not stop thinking about it. Eventually, she went to Afghanistan to look for more of these hidden, secret poems, which are called land eyes.
Land eye means a short, poisonous snake. And this form, the land eye, is spoken by women, for women. It's transmitted ear to ear, voice to voice, and has been over millennia. And it's very subversive. The things that women speak about, the issues of sex, war, longing, grief, separation, are issues that they're really not allowed to talk about in day-to-day life. And so the land eye, because it's collective, because it's anonymous, and because it's oral, allows women to share their innermost sentiments and disown them at the same time. For example, Rahila Muska, the young woman who was killed, could utter that land eye because she could say, well, that's not my poem. And although after her death, her father destroyed the notebooks that survived her, he was unable to kill or to wipe out a poem that was an oral tradition and had been passed among women for centuries.
They're so compact. I mean, these are like haikus in a way, but they're kind of dense with emotion. And I wanted to ask you about some that seem to be love poems to American soldiers, or actually they're sort of more like love-hate poems. So there's one, for instance, "My lover is fair as an American soldier can be. To him I looked dark as a Talib, so he martyred me." Wow.
Yeah. Now that's an old one, and it used to say, "My love is fair as a British soldier can be," because it is a tacit criticism of occupation. And of course, long before the Americans set foot in Afghanistan, there was the 19th century British occupation.
So there's a sense in which the soldiers are simply interchangeable. It's one more occupation for this area.
Oh, absolutely. The soldiers are interchangeable. Occupation is interchangeable. The enemy is interchangeable. And yet the idea of being misread, misunderstood, seen in a mistaken form, that the outsider is so blind to Afghan life that he will not understand or recognize his own lover. That's what stands at the heart of that poem.
There are also some really chilling anti-American poems. There's one, kind of couldn't get it out of my head. Wait, let me find it. This one's written by a mother. "My Nobby was shot down by a drone. May God destroy your sons, America. You murdered my own."
Yes. So the name of this mother was Chandana, and she did not sing this poem to me directly. This was repeated to me by her cousin. So she never would have written this poem because she cannot write. So this is just an oral tradition, and she would sing this. She did sing this at a wedding. And men and women are segregated for weddings, as they would be for any ceremony in Afghan society. And so in a women's wedding, typically at henna night before she's married, when the bride is decorated with henna on her hands and feet, women sing land eyes. They sing them with a small hand drum called a daira. And yes, this mother, to her understanding, he was killed by a drone. Now, does she know that for sure? No way. But the drones are very prevalent in Afghan society now. In both the common consciousness and the rage against ongoing occupation, but also in the land eyes, which was shocking to me that they'd entered the language of the land eyes themselves.
Well, so some of these seem to be supportive of the Talibs, but then others aren't. There's one, "May God destroy the Taliban and end their wars. They've made Afghan women widows and whores."
Mm-hmm. There's rage. There's rage against all forms of oppression in these poems. And the Taliban, you know, they're not popular. But here's what happens in a village. And this is why women sing about the Taliban with such disgust. In a village, the Taliban will come through and demand that a family give over one of their sons. And so that leads to rage, because in the same way that Chandana would sing about her rage at the Americans for killing her son Nabi, she would sing about her rage at the Taliban for taking one of her sons for their ranks as well. So And moreover, because women have suffered so much under the rule of the Taliban regime, which still rules and has parallel governments in much of rural Afghanistan today, the hypocrisy of the religiosity of the Taliban and yet the way in which when they were in power, they, you know, abused women, that really is a common theme of both women's talking to one another, but of course of the Landais as well.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting to me is the women's voices as they come out of these are so powerful. I mean, they just kind of jump off the page at you. I mean, these are not the voices of shy or modest or humble women. Did that surprise you?
It did and it didn't. I mean, because I've been working in Afghanistan for more than a decade on and off, I had some sense of the volubility, the rage, the earthiness that with which many Afghan women speak all the time. And as sort of, you know, I wear a couple of hats as a journalist and a poet. And so I love sort of looking at the edges of society. For both me and for the photographer Seamus Murphy, with whom I was working, who's worked in Afghanistan for 25 years, one of the things we wanted to do is sort of explode the image that we have in the West of an Afghan woman being, you know, a mute ghost beneath a blue burqa, because she is anything but. And the frankness with which women speak is woefully underreported because there's not much space for it in the news headlines. So what we were trying to do is get beyond those headlines and let these women speak for themselves.
And yet, at the same time, they may have strong voices, but so many of these poems are about their oppression. I mean, the really heartbreaking ones to me often are young girls who clearly are being married against their will. Oh, what's the one there's something about? I dropped the spinach on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
How does that one go?
That one goes, today I dropped the spinach on the floor. Now the old goat stands in the corner swinging a 2x4.
Yeah. So one of the things that I find difficult reading these is that each one is kind of like a window onto another woman or girl's life and often onto a moment of pain or torment. I mean, her existence is pain, and it's all summed up in these two lines, nine words, and it's not resolved. You know, so you're just left wondering about her. What happened to her? I mean, you must have that feeling even more strongly having met so many of these women.
Yeah. I mean, separation. You set fire to the heart and home of every lover.
Is there a Landai you would leave us with?
Sure. When sisters sit together, they are always praising their brothers. When brothers sit together, they are selling their sisters to others.
Eliza Griswold published a collection of Afghan Landais in an edition of Poetry magazine with photographs of the Pashtun region by Seamus Murphy. You can see the photographs and read more poems on our website at ttbook.org. Brothers and Sisters and the Cruelty of Separation. That's a subject at the heart of Khaled Hosseini's latest novel, And the Mountains Echoed. Hosseini's the Afghan-born best-selling author of The Kite Runner. And to wrap up this section of the program, here he reads from his new novel, a story of two children separated by war.
The section I'm about to read is we meet Pari, who is a little girl who was torn from her brother. She's now, I guess, in her 60s. And she's living in France, and she has received a phone call through which she learns about the fact that she had a brother. Paris' hands shake. A startling thing is happening to her, something truly remarkable. The picture of it in her mind is of an axe striking soil and suddenly rich black oil bubbling up to the surface. This is what's happening to her. Memory is struck upon, rising up from the depths. She gazes out the window in the direction of the brasserie, but what she sees is not the skinny waiter beneath the awning, black apron tied at the waist and shaking a cloth over a table, but a little red wagon with a squeaky wheel bouncing along beneath a sky of unfurling clouds. rolling over ridges and down dried-up gullies, up and down ochre hills that loom and then fall away. She sees washing lines and women squatting by a stream, and a hawk-nosed man digging a ditch, shirt plastered to his back with sweat, and a veiled woman bent over a cooking fire. But something else, too, at the edge of it all, at the rim of her vision, and this is what draws her most, an elusive shadow, a figure, at once soft and hard, the softness of a hand holding hers, the hardness of knees where she'd once rested her cheek. She searches for his face, but it evades her, slips from her each time she turns to it. Paris feels a hole opening up in her. There has been in her life, all her life, a great absence. Somehow she has always known. "Brother," she says, unaware she's speaking, unaware she's weeping.
Khaled Hosseini, reading from his most recent novel, And the Mountains Echoed. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Bookmarks, writers on books they love.
My name is Hanan Sheikh, and I want to talk about the book I really treasure. It is a novel called Season of Migration to the North by the late Sudanese novelist Tayyib Saleh. When I first read this book in Arabic, it was in the late 60s, and I was captivated. Everything about this novel was different from anything I had ever read before. It was set in both East and West. Apart from its astonishing prose, new, modern, but yet mixed with classical Arabic poetry, Islam, and Shakespeare as well. Its explicit, daring sensuality and sexuality shocked me at that time. Whether in the character of a woman called Bint Mahjoub. She was 80-year-old woman in the protagonist's village in Sudan who debated and joked about sex with men only as she smoked with them and drank alcohol. And she thought that women's circumcision was not that bad after all, for women will try harder in order to reach their climax. Women will try harder. And thus they pleasure men. The novel is about one man's exile border, and it is loaded with years of imperial oppression. He didn't know what to do with this sudden freedom he had. Though he learned from former rulers and become a brilliant economist, he, Mustafa Saeed, couldn't live in harmony with this past. He found it impossible to juggle between the world he came from and the West. You know, after so many years, I still find myself thinking of the opening passage of the novel. And in Arabic, it's so beautiful, and in English too. He says, "It was, gentlemen, after a long absence, 7 years to be exact, during which time I was studying in Europe, that I returned to my people." The translation was superb, translated by Dennis Johnson Davis. And I recommend this book. It's an amazing, different novel.
Novelist Hanan al-Sheikh. She recommends Season of Migration to the North by Tayyib Saleh. Find out more on our website, ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. And speaking of books and writing, this week we're thinking about science fiction. We've got a sci-fi flash fiction contest going called 3-Minute Futures. And for some inspiration, here's the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 winner, Charles Yu.
When it happens, this is what happens. I shoot myself. Not, you know, my self-self. I shoot my future self. He steps out of a time machine, introduces himself as Charles Yu. What else am I supposed to do? I kill him. I kill my own future.
That's the opening of Charles Yu's critically acclaimed new novel, How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe. Charles Yu is one of the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 award winners. His debut novel takes place in Minor Universe 31, a vast story space on the outskirts of fiction where paradox fluctuates like the stock market and time travel is just another business. The plot? Well, it's a little hard to describe.
It's a book about a time machine repairman who has been working and living inside of his time machine. And in the process of the story, he gets caught into a time loop where he goes back through his own memories and childhood with his parents growing up and has to figure out how to escape the time loop. Mm-hmm. And that's not a capsule description at all. That was too long.
That was good. Well, so is the idea here that not everyone can be Luke Skywalker or Captain Kirk, that even in a science fictional universe, someone has to supply the onboard meals and process the leave reports?
Exactly. There's a part in the book where it refers to people that are in accounts receivable on the Death Star. And I think that's something that I've been interested in from the beginning of when I started writing, is the characters who are in the background, who do the necessary jobs and, you know, their stories.
What exactly does a time travel repairman do?
Well, he actually does know how to fix the machine, which, you know, is based on not so much real technology in terms of circuits, but it's based on grammar and memory and regret. It's a time machine slash literary device. But the main thing he does is talk to the person who broke their machine, because the reason they broke it was most likely that they were trying to go back and change their past. People rent time machines. They think they can change the past. Then they get there and find out causality doesn't work the way they thought it did. They get stuck. Stuck in places they didn't mean to go. In places they did mean to go. In places they shouldn't have tried to go. They get into trouble. Logical, metaphysical, etc. That's where I come in. I go and get them out. I tell people, I have a job and I have job security. I have a job because I know how to fix the cooling module on the quantum decoherence engine of the TM-31. But the reason I have job security is that people have no idea how to make themselves happy, even with a time machine. I have job security because what the customer wants, when you get right down to it, is to relive his very worst moment over and over and over again. Willing to pay a lot of money to do it, too.
I think you were a biochem major in college, right?
I was, yeah.
But so you're clearly someone who reads a lot of physics and cosmology just for fun. I mean, I noticed in the acknowledgments to the book, you include a kind of shout-out to a book called The Fabric of Reality by David Deutsch. Most people just thank their families. So what was it about this particular book that influenced you so much?
It's a physics book for sure, but it's so wide-ranging. It's about this idea of a quantum multiverse, which is one interpretation of what it means that we live in a quantum mechanical universe, is that at an uncountably large number of points in the universe, it's actually splitting off into separate universes. And all of those things exist simultaneously in this thing called the multiverse. Now, of course, this novel only takes place in one universe, but that idea is underlying the story that I tried to tell. And I should say that I was a biochem major, but I was like a B-minus biochem major. So my talent, if I have any, is in like totally misusing science for literary purposes, which probably angers scientists everywhere.
So what are some of the ideas that you love playing with that you've explored in this book?
Well, the you touched on it earlier, the sort of alternate self idea is definitely one. If we're living in anything like a quantum multiverse, what would it mean for us as selves? What does it do to your sense of who you are if there are an almost infinite number of you? I like the juxtaposition of those ideas in a sense of how do we tell the stories of ourselves, our families. And because at root, this is a story about a father and son and a mother and how a family is to some degree, I think, a story you construct about, you know, while you're living it and also later. The earliest memory I have of my own dad is the two of us sitting on my bed as he reads me a book we have checked out from the local library. I am three. I don't remember what the story is or even the title of the book. What I do remember is the way I fit between his right arm and his body, and the way his neck and the underside of his chin look in the soft yellow light of my lamp, which has a cloth lampshade, light blue, covered by an alternating pattern of robots and spaceships. This is what I remember. One, the little pocket of space he creates for me. Two, how it is enough. Three, the sound of his voice. Four, the way those spaceships look, shot through from behind with light, so that every stitch in the fabric of the surface is a hole and a source, a point and an absence. Five, how the bed feels like a little spaceship itself.
In terms of that central emotional story, which is sometimes sad, but it's the heart of the book about the son searching for his lost father. Does that come from anything personal in your own life? I mean, you have a father. You are a father.
Well, I mean, I think becoming a father relatively recently, I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. It certainly made me appreciate my own father in ways, and my mother, in ways that I couldn't have ever guessed. I mean, people told me, my own parents told me plenty, you know, just wait till you have kids and you'll really appreciate your parents. And that, I mean, that was, it's been a huge sort of perspective shift for me.
I know that's this cliched thing we say, you know, just wait till you become a parent. But it is the one experience we all have of the kind of quantum reality of selfhood. I guess I'm sort of thinking about ways in which we all actually have the experience of multiple selves that you write about in this science fiction-y way, but we all kind of do know what that feels like, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm going to have to steal that phrase from you. I mean, I think it's the quantum reality of parenthood is a perfect way to put it. And sometimes just sitting in a room with my children and my parents and feeling like there's some kind of timeline, you know, just looking at the three generations and going, what are we? Like, we're these weird selves that some of my parents is in me, some of me is in my kids, and a lot of it is different too. And we're these kind of weird time travelers in our bodies that are moving through time together. And at some point, you know, some of us will drop off the timeline and new parts of our, I guess, lineage will pop up. And to think of that kind of family as this long, you know, unbroken line through time, you know, with some beginning and some end, I guess, it is a really strange thing. You're right. Family itself is a very sort of strange reality.
Every time there's a big new scientific paradigm, it takes a long time for it to kind of filter its way into popular consciousness. I wonder if you see yourself as part of that kind of process here where the basic insights of quantum physics, which are hard enough to grasp with our rational minds, are kind of gradually soaking themselves into our culture and into our ways of thinking about ourselves, our families, our relationships.
You know, I think it's in some tiny way, I hope to be part of a generation, I guess, or a group of people that might be more preoccupied with this than certain other kinds of stories. And the thing about quantum physics, though, you're right, it's so hard to understand. I mean, even the scientists who made quantum physics into part of our physics don't even understand it. You know, I mean, they say that nobody really understands it. It's so fundamentally weird that if you really, really understand it at all, you realize that it's basically incomprehensible. I mean, what does it mean that, you know, light is both a particle and a wave? Or what does it mean that particles can influence each other from a distance, things like quantum entanglement or the double slit experiment where light sort of, you know, photons will be either going through a slit or not, depending on whether or not you're looking at them. It's mind-boggling, right? I mean, on the most basic level, it's...
But is it mind-boggling in a fun way? Like, do you love this? Or do you just want to scratch your head and go, ah, I just don't get it?
I love it. I love it because I'm glad I'm not a physicist, and I'm clearly not smart enough to be one, but I love feeling like we're all in this boat. Even physicists are going, what is going on? Like, how could this be? You know, and it allows more mystery and possibility, I think, than if things were like, oh yeah, it's just like that. You know, Newton's mechanics, that's it. There's nothing else to it. We know exactly how everything works. Now we just got to figure out a couple other details, but we pretty much have the theory of everything down already. That'd be sort of a boring universe to live in, you know? I mean, it's better that we're just totally dumbfounded.
Charles Yu is the author of How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe and the story collection Sorry, Please, Thank You. If you also love science and fiction, why not try your hand at our Flash Fiction Contest, 3-Minute Futures? We're looking for 500-word science fiction stories set in the near future. Kim Stanley Robinson will judge the contest, and the winning entries will be dramatized by Star Trek actress Gates McFadden, also known as Dr. Beverly Crusher. Our contest partners are the University of Wisconsin's Center for the Humanities and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. The deadline is March 1st, coming up soon. Details on our website, ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Kirill Owen, Steve Paulson, and Stephanie Youngblood. I'm Ann Strainchamps. We'll see you again next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.